And we have found that it's the most vital and important part of understanding a person, what we call religious identity. So if we have belief and behavior as two sides, that we have a corner over here. By the way, Perry and I have concluded, like most sociologists, that the two mechanisms of truth are 2x2 tables and triangles. if you can fit something into a 2x2 table or into a triangle, you've reached parsimony, I think. And pretty close to truth. Building off, I think, our reading of Fowler, what we've tried to do is put over here on the third leg as valuing that part of the process of creating, and if we call this the whole, a religious identity, is not only believing and behaving, but where is this person in terms of his or her valuing? Valuing a relationship to God, valuing a relationship to community, valuing relationships within family, etc. And as an example of this, the importance of this leg, I want to share with you a conversation I had with a woman just a few months ago. I was putting together another questionnaire, as I do all the time and frequently in my sleep as well. And I had taken the items over to her and asked her to fill them out. And there were 10 or 15 items, and I wanted her to respond to them. Then we talked about how she answered them. And one of the items was about belief in God. And it was, she had to respond on a 1 to 5 scale, "I believe in God." And on a 1 to 5 scale, she put, with 5 meaning, yes, definitely, I believe in God, she put down either a 2 or a 3, I don't recall now. But as I went down further in the questionnaire, there's another item that says, "I know that God loves me." And she had put a 4 on that. So I talked about that. I said, "Now, help me understand. What you're saying is you're not sure whether you believe in God, but you know that He loves you." And she stopped and thought for a minute. She says, "Yes, that's exactly how I feel. I'm not sure that I know that there is a God," he or she, depending upon your own perspective, but I know that He loves me." Now, what we're talking about really there is the difference between the belief dimension, the cognitive, rational dimension, and that valuing, feeling dimension that she's responding to, that in this period of uncertainty, she maintained and held on to longer this notion of a relationship, despite the fact that she'd been moving towards not a lack of certainty about whether or not the other person in the relationship actually existed. And we find, too, that if you look at the process of activation, that what changes most in that and first in that activation process is the valuing. That when you see people who have not been participating in the church, and I think we find this also true in conversion, that there may be several elements on the belief and behavior dimension in terms of institutional Mormonism that are lacking, but that most people believe and many of them behave as though they're LDS, despite the fact that they're not currently participating in religion. And that what is missing is the valuing part, either feeling that they are not valued, that they can't be valued, that they can't do what needs to be done to be valued, and that those successful activators, for example, are the ones who can go into a person's life and work on this dimension, work on the faith dimension, building relationships with community and God. Now, let me move on quickly. The second thing that I think is useful about James Fowler's work, which really has more to do with his stages, and he'll say more of that this afternoon. He has 6 different stages the idea that people progress through them. And I don't want to spend the time to point out, as I'm sure most critics do, that it's difficult to know whether or not there's a natural progression and whether or not you've ever been able to find a stage six, and there are very few stage fives, that whole problem with the notion of stage theory. But what it does suggest is that there is a diversity of psychological and social styles in any religious community and in Mormon communities. And that one of the conflicts I think we need to somehow learn to resolve as we create communities in our local congregations is to allow people, encourage people who have different psychological styles or in different stages to feel comfortable with one another. As this hasn't really to do with the stage theories, but I was at a recent retreat with about 90 women, many of whom are frustrated because of their experience in their local wards. And as part of the process, we used the Myers-Briggs personality. And everyone found out what their type was. And I don't know if you know about the Myers-Briggs, but there are four dimensions, and each has a two modes on each dimension. But the one thing that we found out is that 99% of the women in that group were ands on the second dimension. Now, what that is saying, even if you don't understand Myers-Briggs, is that the reason the women were there at the retreat was that they had some similarity in the way they viewed the world and responded to the world in personality type or structure or whatever, if we can trust the tests. But that was so similar on that dimension, particularly when I think only 25% of the population are supposed to be ends on a normative scale, that you have this group of ends that find one another and like to go on retreats, and they didn't... And they didn't even know why. Okay? Well, what's interesting is the ends are intuitive versus, what's the other one?
Sensing.
And the ends like to sort of look for change and possibilities and much more open. S's are kind of much more concerned with detail and structure and meaning. Is that a good... I hope I didn't bastardize that in the process. But anyway, these were liberal Mormon women, as you might Someone said the S's were preparing for primary. And please don't take that negatively, because S's are frequently really good with children. I mean, and very comfortable with that. And I'm sort of negating my point by saying what I just said, but the point is to be able to find a place for all personality types and perspectives, given that we all have this same center of value and trying to understand that. The third thing I want to say very quickly, and Fowler, I think, is moving in this direction very much so, and can probably teach us something about this some more as he talks to us this afternoon. But the concern that if we really look at individual development, we know that people don't all develop at the same rate, and it's not always tied to age, and people go through different issues, etc. And the question this raises is how do institutions, particularly highly structured institutions like Mormonism, accommodate to the individual differences and developmental cycles? How can religious communities, which is really the focus, I think, of Fowler and his later works, how can religious communities respond to individuals according to where they are in this cycle of development and their ability to think and objectify and struggle with issues. I think I've probably taken up enough time, and so I'll stop at that point, and we can probably raise some questions later.
However loosely the designation of paper may have applied to Marie's work, to mine it is much more loose yet. I wasn't exactly sure of the format, so I had intended to do more or less a talk through and then be responsive to other questions and comments. There's a sense in which I think I owe maybe all of you and maybe Dr. Fowler an apology. It seems to me that if you want a critic of something, all you have to do is go far enough out on the lunatic fringe and there will be someone who can criticize anything. Okay. So I'm not sure what my place is. I don't think there's any such thing as a typical Latter-day Saint, so I'm not sure I can give Mormon perspectives on this. I can give a Mormon's perspective on the work. I'm not a typical psychologist. I'm the one they always call in when they want somebody to fight somebody else. I'm the one they point at them. So I don't think that it would be a fair assessment of Dr. Fowler's work in regards to psychology. So I guess what I can do is try to give a peculiar psychologist's and individual Mormon's assessment of Dr. Fowler's latest work. I very much liked the overall point of his latest book, Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian. The central focus of the whole thing was the notion that our culture has lost what he refers to as a vocational ideal, meaning something to animate us, something to call forth our dedication, or in probably as LDS people would say it, something to call forth our best consecrated efforts, something to enliven us and to give meaning to what we do and give direction. And I agree that our culture has lost that. Something that I also find impressive is the extent to which he takes a non-individualist stance and tries to show that the best vocational ideal is a non-individualistic one. It's one where we become really one of each other and members of a community. There's a self-forgetfulness there, or an emptying of self, as he calls it. But, and this will be the basis of my criticism, I don't think that is a happy solution, because I detect running through the entirety of the book an uneasy tension between the individual and the culture, between individualism and relationship, the person, the group, those kinds of things. And I want to make a guess as to maybe the origins of that uneasy tension that remains. I also developed a deep appreciation for Dr. Fowler as an individual, as a Christian, as a thinker, and as a writer. That comes through very clearly in the book, and I suspect, although he may challenge that, I suspect it's more than a little bit autobiographical in its form and in the message that it takes. Now, I guess to the more critical part. There were other things I liked about it, too, and I recommend the book highly to you. One of the little disingenuous things I do at some forums, especially, I like to do it with Marxists. You can really get the goat of any good Marxist when you say, well, that's all well and good, but it's just not radical enough. Because whatever else Marxism may be, it is self-proclaimedly the most radical position available. But I think it's easy to show with a fairly easy analysis that they're not radical enough. And I guess that's what I'm going to suggest is my response to Dr. Fowler's work. And on the basis of this assessment, I think the other criticisms fall in line. I guess one way to phrase it is that I think this work of Dr. Fowler's is a very good statement of, a very good, more than a statement, a defense and a reiteration of the classic Enlightenment project, which is the development of faith. But that, in that, I think, is its most critical problem. Let me suggest what I mean by that, by giving a two-minute history of philosophy. The early Greeks, it seems, were obsessed with a particular issue, at least as we read interpretations of their philosophy, and that is the question of being versus becoming. the question of what is there really and what changes. Being is change, becoming is change, and being is what must not change. And that's an important issue, because if something keeps changing, you can't ever be satisfied that you've got it or that you know it, because it's going to change on you the next minute, and you really can't know it. So the Greeks were very concerned with the establishment of being, the essence of something, certainty, so that certainty would be possible. And thus we have Plato's forms, the Aristotelian theos, water and air and fire. All of those things were attempts to make the world hold still, and let's come up with the essential thing. The pursuit of the essential thing that's not going to change on you, I think, is fair to call metaphysics. That's the metaphysical project. Okay? And so the history of philosophy unfolded with the attempt to specify what the essential thing is, up until the beginnings of the modern period, and I think we can look to Descartes for this. The modernist move was to realize, through the work of Occam and other people, you can't ever know God, who's up there with those things that don't change. You can't ever know the absolutes and the ultimates, so we will concentrate our efforts on knowing our own minds. Because certainty comes by employing the power of the mind to reach certainty about the things that we can be certain about, such as quasi-mathematical principles, laws, abstractions, the ultimate abstractions. Okay? So the search for certainty, or I'm going to say classical epistemology, was born. So we're still after the search for certainty, only we've moved it now into the individual mind. And the quest, the human project, is to try to achieve some contact with the ultimate within the parameters and boundaries of our individual minds. Okay. Now, to put the Christian period on top of all this, for a number of years, I think the notion of God interfaced very nicely with the Platonic forms, the real Platonic world. Then the Aristotelian theos, and then this abstract, ultimate, whatever there was to be known, toward which the mind pushes and tries to progress. The understanding of which will be the most abstract, the most ultimate, the most complete, the final, the end, the last thing, ultimate certainty. Okay? Now, and I think that pretty well characterizes, in one form or other, oversimplified, but in one form or other, I think that pretty well characterizes theology from that time forward. Okay? Then we ask ourselves, what does faith become? And I think, if I can coin a one-liner, faith must become, since the Cartesian project is so difficult, faith must become what we must settle for when we don't have certainty. Okay? So that the faithful life is the life lived in the face of the uncertainty and the inability to reach the ultimate. It's what you have to settle for because you can't really know. It's what you do when you don't know. It's what you do when you're trying to know. It fills the holes that remain in our knowledge, in our quest for certainty. And this, I think, is the fairly traditional view of faith, and not, I think, alien to a view of faith that most LDS people would identify with as well. And thus, I think, the precipitation of faith crises, because if you recognize that faith is what you settle for when you can't know, you're always haunted by the fact that, I don't really know. And this is the stuff of which faith crises are born. Well, now this then is the one other leg of modernist philosophy, I think, is the leg of individualism, where the quest for certainty must be carried out in my mind. We must all do, in a sense, what Descartes did for himself. We must go to the ultimate bracketing, so to speak. We must rip out everything and trust only our own minds, only our own thoughts. And to know something is to have that individual private assurance of it. So we have moved our emphasis in understanding the world, in understanding God, in having faith, to the inside of each of us. So it becomes an internal struggle. And our conceptualization of people is that we are first and foremost cognitively encapsulated or imprisoned individuals. And thus, in order to achieve a sort of Christian vocation, we must somehow overcome that alienation from one another, that sense of our own individuality, and dissolve ourselves into a community. But it's always a struggle, and that tension, I think, carries through Dr. Fowler's work. He points out very well, and rightly, I believe, that that should be the end toward which Christian vocation strives, but that the culmination of it always comes at a price, and we sense the price. The price is dissolution of something individually essential about us. And so community becomes an achievement, something we have to work at and achieve. Really, I would guess an achievement of the faith struggle as it comes to characterize the highest levels of faith development. Well, I'm going to suggest that there's an alternative way of looking at this, which is not common, I guess, in psychology, or maybe unarticulated often, but it's the only one with which I personally have been able to come to grips. Now, this book divides itself rather neatly, I believe, in two parts. There are six chapters, and the first three are much more clearly and heavily psychological. And in my reading of it, I took this many notes, if you can see, of that section of the book. And of the last three chapters, I took only that many notes. So I'm not sure where to center my evaluation. But let me first start with the psychological constructs. I should say that in my mind, the thing which ties the first half, which is heavily psychological, to the second half of the book is the Enlightenment Project. Okay, that is to say, if you see psychology as fundamentally seeking to understand and arrive at a clear conception of human beings as private egos within a metaphysical system, etc., and if you see faith as defined in terms of that same project, then the first half and the second half of the book fit together nicely. The project of psychology, which is the articulation and the development of the Enlightenment presumptions of individual consciousness, and the project of the second half of the book, which is the articulation and development of faith as Cartesian project, then there's the commonality and the theme, and the psychology and the theology, the faith development fit together very nicely. But that also, I think, is the problem with the point of view, and the reason where I would say, for my tastes, it's not near radical enough. Now, let me comment just a minute, I believe, or I hope, on the notion of stages of development. The book talks about the Ericksonian stages and Levinson stages and Gilligan stages, but I want to concentrate on Dr. Fowler's own stages, the stages of faith development. And let me suggest that I find two aspects of any structural development theory problematic. The first one is that in order to take a structural developmental model seriously, and if you're going to have one at all, you ought to take it seriously, for heaven's sake. In order to take it seriously, you must believe in the reality, put quotation marks around that, whatever you need to do. You must believe that somehow the structure is real. Paul Ricoeur, a French continental philosopher, criticizes the philosophical structuralists soundly because he says, if you ask them why they study underlying structures of things, they'll respond to you as Sir Edmund Hillary said, because they're there. Okay, if they're not there, then any structural development model is just another narrative among narratives. And if we are content to allow any structural developmental model to be just another narrative among narratives to help us make sense of our journey through life, then I think that's fine. But most of the time, and maybe Professor Fowler can comment on this, most of the time, people who make such models wouldn't waste their time making a narrative among other narratives. They want to talk this way because they believe the fundamental structure is somehow there. Okay. Well, such structures who are fundamentally there, I think, get us into a whole host of metaphysical problems, which I haven't got time to get into. But they, in a word, I think, destroy our humanity. We become tail ends, so to speak, of the dog of structure. We become superficial manifestations of a real story. Anything we do on the surface must be translated to something more profound. Now, I get the feeling that Dr. Fowler holds his developmental stage theory appropriately loosely, and I give him credit for that, much more so than I do some of the others that are around. The second major criticism that I would like to make of structural developmental models, and it applies especially to Kohlberg and Gilligan, and I see the same spirit coming into Dr. Fowler's work, it is the notion that, in the case of Kohlberg, the development of faith, and in the case of Kohlberg, the development of morality, and in the case of Dr. Fowler, the development of faith, is based on increasing cognitive sophistication. Okay. Now, that makes sense in regards to the Enlightenment project. If what we're about is refining our individual minds, our individual consciousnesses, in order to get more and more close to the truth, in order to apprehend the ultimate, then it makes sense that the more you go, that's development, that's progress. But in plain, simple terms, what this tells us is the smarter you are, the more faith you can have. And I'm not convinced that that's an accurate statement. In the case of Kohlberg, flatly, the smarter you are, the more moral you are. Okay? And right in the middle of Kohlberg's stages, there's this poor level where people are moral because people tell them what they ought to do and they believe them and they think it's fine. But gosh, they're stuck in the middle and they never make it to those higher stages. And there's a stage in the middle of Dr. Fowler's work, I think, which to me speaks of a similar kind of a thing. It's let me see if I can find it. It's stage 3, the mythic literal faith. Okay, here you start to rely on what people tell you. You value what the community values. You like what the community says. You believe you don't have any trouble. Stage 3. Okay. Not quite up there yet. And the move that moves you to the next stages is cognitive sophistication. Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to simply claim that cognitive sophistication may lead to an increase of faith, or it may lead to more effective ways of self-deception and sin and justification and amorality and a whole bunch of other stuff. So linking the development of faith to cognitive sophistication is, for me, a great difficulty. Now to the end of the book, I guess, and the more theological comments that I want to make. Dr. Cornwall pointed out that Dr. Fowler's project, and he makes that explicit in the book, and in some sense it's a good move to make, and from my perspective it may be a bad move to make at the same time. Part of his project is to develop a notion of faith development that is content, that's not that content-free. That the content of any particular faith community or set of values isn't really important. Faith is a generic. And again, that's the Cartesian project, you see. The generic search of individual mind to capture the essential, unchangeable thingness of the universe is generic. And it doesn't matter the content, the time, the place, the person. It'll all turn out the same. I find that extremely problematic from my point of view. And I'm here espousing a hermeneutic continentalist sort of philosophy. I think that every human endeavor, human action, human sentiment, human belief or faith is entirely content, situation, history, and person specific. Now, that's not to say we can't generalize, because we live in a world just chock full of commonality. Okay, but the content of my faith makes it different from something without that content. And not just superficially different, fundamentally different. To understand it, we must understand it in the specificity, in the concreteness, in the historical contextual situatedness. And we can really never understand it in the generic. Okay? So we are able to generalize not because there's an essential thing towards which all doctrines or movements toward faith strive, but because we have an essential commonality of community and experience and history and culture and language. Now, with that in mind, I guess what I'm going to suggest is there are two ways to read the last three chapters of this book. And I read them both ways at the same time and ended up feeling sort of schizophrenic, but I enjoyed it. The first way is to appreciate Dr. Fowler's language and his point. And his point is we must get outside ourselves. We must yield to the promptings of the Spirit. We must form a partnership with God. We must rise above the narrow concerns of self and community and develop this vocation And that is the highest form of faith. And I agree with that. Now I have to go back with my hermeneutic mindset and say, but wait, the content of this thing is important. And here we come down, I guess, to Mormonism. Dr. Fowler suggests that what he wants to create is a classic, a Christian classic, a narrative that tells us what it means to be a Christian and what it means to have faith. And he lays out the skeleton of this classic beginning on page 82 of the book. And the first two bones of the skeleton are that there, we must talk about God. Okay. And the second is that we must talk about creation. And from the rest of the book, it is quite clear that the God that Dr. Fowler has in mind as the God of traditional Christianity is, in a sense, the God of the Cartesian project. Okay, the ultimate, the unchanging, the essential, in a sense, pure reason. Okay, being as being itself, or to quote Dr. Fowler, the principle of being as being itself. Now, that's a different use of the word being from the one Heidegger uses, which I find instructive. And secondly, that the creation bone of the skeleton of the Christian classic is ex nihilo, creation ex nihilo. Now, to me, the most unfortunate consequence of a doctrine of creation ex nihilo is that it makes us individuals. Because, you see, if we create us from nothing, then whatever we are is the first stage of creation, and relationships must then come after that. So we are first and foremost individuals, and relationships are sort of made after the fact. Whereas I would want to maintain that, as near as I can tell, in my personal theology, relationships are fundamental and individuals are not. And thus we have the tension between individuality and relationship, individuality and community that runs through the work. So what I'm going to suggest is, in my particular reading of Mormon theology, being able to enter a partnership or a covenantal relationship, as Dr. Fowler talks about it, with the God of the Cartesian project is in some important ways different from entering a covenantal relationship with a God who has arms of flesh and bone to throw around you, who is a God in time and space, who has a face and lips and uses them, and so forth. What I'm going to suggest is, for me, the God who is important is the temporal God, to use the Heideggerian sense of the word temporality. A God who is within history, not outside history. A God who moves with us and talks with us and so forth, and not the God who is the ultimate end of the project of consciousness. And then creation ex nihilo. Do we make individual creation essential and relationships a superstructure on top of that? Or do we look at us as from the beginning fundamentally related to one another, as in, I think, the essence of the LDS concept of begottenness? To be begotten sons and daughters of God is a very different concept from being creations ex nihilo of God. And that makes a difference. Okay? So the reading of the first two bones of the skeleton of the Christian classic set the stage for the reading of all the rest, which are the doctrine of the fall, liberation and covenant, incarnation, the church, the commonwealth of God, of love and partnership with God. So it changes everything. It doesn't call into question the value of the work, okay? But I think this LDS person, this Heideggerian LDS person, this hermeneutically perverse LDS person, has to read the rest of the vocation very differently. So the fundamental question is the vocational ideal the completion in a communal way of the Cartesian project of self-understanding, or is the volitional ideal relationship, not achieved relationship, but primal, fundamental, primitive relationship with the God of body parts and passions? And if we were to take an LDS perspective on that, I think we would have to read it in the latter way. So I guess in summary, I will just say, not radical enough for this non-Cartesian, at least.
Well, this is exciting. I really do appreciate the work that both Maria Cornwall and Richard Williams have done in reading the two books that we're discussing this morning. and the work that Marie and Perry Cunningham have done. I don't believe Perry introduced himself. Perhaps all of you know who he is. The work that they have done in using some of these ideas in trying to understand the belief and practice of Mormons. It's exciting to have an opportunity for this, in some ways, family discussion, and in other ways, cross-cultural and cross-religious discussion. And I'm going to try to respond in some ways to both what Marie and Richard have done, and try to do that in sufficiently brief time that there'll be some time for some general questions and discussions. They spoke about loose use of the term paper. Since there were not previous papers, my talks are going to be in the 30 seconds. I mean, the response in the 30 seconds I had moving from the chair to here. And if I am killing a little time talking right now, it's because I'm still trying to put together exactly how to respond. But you could say it another way. I've had 15 years to prepare for this, so we'll do the best we can. One of the themes that both of our spokespersons lifted up for us this morning is the way structural developmental theories make a distinction between structure and content. The structuring or the operations by which we know and construct a way of seeing the world and of making sense of our experience versus or as distinguished from the contents of what we know, what we believe, what we're committed to, where we rest our hearts, as Marie put it. Now, I think that's an important distinction to identify, and I agree with Richard that it does have a peculiar history that has a lot to do with the Enlightenment and has a lot to do with those philosophers, Descartes, Kant, Hume, and Kant and others, who developed a project of trying to identify how, by the use of reason, we can reach rational certainty, and how, at least with Kant, we can be honest, can't know with rational certainty. And that did leave, in the Enlightenment project, space for faith, the knowing that can't be rationally proven or rationally grounded. Now, what I want to say in response to both of them is that while that distinction is important to me, it's very clear to me, and I think I've been fairly clear about this in the two books that we're writing about, that you never get access to the structural operations of people's knowing and valuing except by way of their particular beliefs, values, stories, and worldviews. So in our project of research, we spend 2.5 hours trying to invite and to help people bring to word what their beliefs, values, attitudes, and commitments and worldviews are. And then, having turned these interviews into transcripts of 30 to 40 page single-spaced writing, we then try, as we're sorting out the beliefs and values and how they hold together, also the question of, are there some deeper operations of knowing and valuing that account for that particular way of appropriating the traditions that they are part of? So I see the stages of faith as efforts to abstract one part of a whole picture, which is the interplay of structure and content in our knowing, valuing, and committing. And I never want to argue, as I think sometimes Kohlberg and sometimes Piaget and sometimes the Enlightenment Project has done, I never want to try to suggest that the structural side is the most important or the most fundamental and that the other is somehow epiphenomenal or less important. It's very clear to me that if you just look at the structural side, you at best get half the picture. And in some ways, the less important half. Because it is the symbols, the stories, the images, the doctrines, the practices that shape the affective, emotional life and the larger kind of knowing that faith involves. Now, it may well be that particularly in the book Stages of Faith, where I'm laboring to make that distinction, one could forget that I see the interplay of those two dimensions of our knowing and valuing. I think the readings that Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian, the later book, the one that Richard's primarily focusing upon, I think the readings of that book persist in seeing the first half and the second half as being about those two different dimensions and not seeing an integration of them. And that may be partly the responsibility of the author. But let's put it in the record at present, and if you look at my more recent book, The faith development and pastoral care, I think it's more clearly integrated there. It's quite clear to me that the contents of faith are fundamentally important. And when I speak about becoming Christian, I did not intend the second half of the book to be an extension of the Enlightenment Project, and I did not see God and creation as timeless efforts to affirm an essence outside of history. I understood myself to be speaking in a biblical tradition which refers to a creator God who initiates history. The ex nihilo is the affirmation that there was not a substance or a primal space out of which God fashioned the reality that we call the universe and all that's within it, but that out of God's inner Trinitarian community, we see the birth of something essentially new, which in fact is relational from the beginning because God brings it into being for relationship with God, and then the relationship between entities in that creation. Now, I'm already leaping into the debate with Richard, which is what pulls me at the moment. But let me express appreciation for the use that Marie and Perry have made of the triad of belief, behavior, and valuing. My way of talking about that triad is to say that your faith or mine, as a lived entity, involves our commitment to a center or centers of value, which is that valuing dimension, that which draws the affections of our hearts, exerts ordering power in our lives in terms of our loves. Worth and worship are etymologically related, a center of value. Secondly, I think our faith as a lived entity has to do with the images of power with which we align ourselves as finite creatures in a dangerous world. With what institutions, with what powers do we try to align ourselves so as to feel that we will be secured or maintained or sustained in a dangerous world as finite creatures who are attached to other finite creatures? And in the third place, I suggest that our faith involves the master story or stories by which we try to make sense of our lives and give shape to them. And by a master story, I mean the narrative, conscious or unconscious, by which we deal with such questions as, what is life really about? What does it mean to be a good man or a good woman? What is the nature of the universe? Who is ultimately in charge? And how do we shape ourselves so as to be responsive to that universe? It's a little different than belief, behavior, and valuing, but it's similar. The center of values, the image of power, the master stories by which we shape and live our lives. I appreciate very much Marie's lifting up the possibility of looking at stages in relation to personality types or styles, and her calling our attention to the fact that any adult audience is a kind of ecology of different ways of making meaning. The kind of pluralism within a community is a fascinating thing. And then how to find in a community, and this bears on Richard's issue as well, how to find in a community those patterns of ritual, those patterns of interaction, those patterns of behavior that both allow us to be deeply related to each other and to participate in shared meanings, but at the same time, how to be individuals and distinctly responsible persons is, I think, one of the most interesting questions in religious education and in the leadership of communities. There's some fascinating work going on at the present time correlating Myers-Briggs types with faith development stages. And I think that's going to, in some ways, diminish the overwhelming emphasis upon the notion of there being, quote, higher stages. And it's going to put more pressure upon us who are doing hierarchical stage theories to think in terms of typologies and variations rather than just hierarchy. Now let me shift to talking a little about the Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian book in a dialogue with Richard. Let me say just a word about where that book came from and why I wrote it in the way I did. At the heart of that book, from my standpoint, is an effort to retrieve a doctrine that Mormons may never have lost, but I think has been lost in our larger society, an adequate conception of vocation. Vocation, vocare, comes from a biblical theme in both the Old and the New Testaments. It is, in the Greek New Testament, it is the term klesis, calling. And I want to retrieve vocation as understood in terms of the response a person makes with his or her total life to the call of God to partnership. And I'll go so far as to suggest that we have an ontological vocation, a vocation that comes with our being to respond to this invitation that God gives us to partnership. I don't mean that vocation can be limited or restricted to the work we do, as important as the work we do may be. If we limited vocation to work, we would eliminate children, we would eliminate retired persons or unemployed persons or persons whose work is the care of children in the home. So it's not a primary identification with work or career or profession that I have in mind when I speak of vocation. Rather, if we speak of vocation as the response a person makes with his or her total life to the call of God to partnership, we see that it can involve our relationships, can involve our leisure activities, our recreational activities, our life as citizens, as members of a larger community, our religious lives, our spiritual lives, and our work. Vocation then becomes a coherence-giving pattern of order and loyalty to our lives in the manyness of our lives. The book is really about the effort to regain, reclaim this notion of vocation over against what I take to be one of the principal heresies of our particular culture, the theme that primary calling of human beings is to actualize themselves or to fulfill themselves. That was a liberating message when humanistic psychology began to offer it over against narrow and restrictive religious backgrounds that in some sense ask us to give ourselves to God before we had ever claimed ourselves, or that so restricted us with rules and regulations or with profound feelings of lack of self-worth and of guilt. That good news about the human potential for self-actualization and self-fulfillment was a liberating word, but it was a one-sided word. And that's really what the book is trying to say. And it's trying to say that the doctrine of vocation in the framework of a particular tradition, and here I disagree with Richard, I'm not trying to offer a version of a Christian classic that is some sort of generic faith. Rather, I'm trying to press for a retrieval of the particular dimensions of Christian belief in Christian community. I'm trying to argue that vocation acknowledges all that we would want to acknowledge about human potential and its nurture, but does so in such a way as to honor the paradox that I think is at the very heart of the biblical witness, and particularly the New Testament, that says it is in giving ourselves that we are filled. It is in dying that we live. It is in spending and being spent in the service of others that we are most fully led to those sorts of connections and relationships in which our wholeness and salvation as persons can be realized and claimed. In that sense, I was trying to write an apologetic book. And I'm using apologetic in the classical sense of writing a book that tries to persuade, awaken, seduce, lure persons to an alternate way of seeing the world. So what did I do? I started in the first three chapters with what has become a kind of lingua franca, a kind of common language for dealing with people's concerns with their lives and their meanings, namely psychology. And I asked the question why developmental psychology has become a kind of helpful paradigm for making sense of our lives in a pluralistic, secularizing culture. And I argue that developmental psychologists, for good or for ill, have become kind of secular ordo-salutises, secular versions of a path toward wholeness or salvation. And that a book like Gail Sheehy's book of 18 years ago, called Passages, provided a kind of language, along with those of Erickson and some of the other figures that are drawn here, has provided a kind of language for us to talk about where we are in our life pilgrimages, and to name the pains and the struggles, and to get a sense of meaning and direction in the experiences we're undergoing. And I try to capitalize upon that interest to engage people in looking at the deeper and more significant meanings of our lives and asking what is a good human life? What does it mean to be a good man or a good woman? And then the second half of the book, which is meant to be explicitly Christian, is an effort to engage that set of concerns about what makes a good man or a good woman, or how does a life unfold, and is there any deeper pattern to our unfolding, means to engage it with the content, the invitations, and the beliefs of the Christian tradition. To me, one of the most important parts of that second half of the book is one that Richard didn't mention. It's where I balance this concern with faith as a way of seeing and knowing, what he calls the equation of faith with a growth toward cognitive sophistication. I try to balance that with a rich sense of faith as involving a forming of the emotions. And I talk about how in community, through worship, through teaching, through prayer, praise, proclamation, and through music, as well as through service and the risky involvement in mission, we try to form a set of emotions that are specifically Christian. I've noted these to myself, the emotions of gratitude and giving thanks. Now, one doesn't have to be a particular stage to develop a profound sense of gratitude and giving thanks for the gift of life, for creation, for other human beings, for the opportunity to live and serve. The attitudes and emotions of holy fear and awe. Our society doesn't do much to nurture, generally, feelings of holy fear and awe. But religious communities need to help us identify with Isaiah in the sixth chapter of the prophet's book, where Isaiah has a vision of God as exalted and high and lifted up. And he says, woe is me, I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. A sense of the awareness of who we are and our distance from God, which makes us open to God's invitation to redemption and reunion. And then the emotions of joy and suffering, and how in any depth of religious commitment we have to come to terms with the dimension of suffering, and with all that seems to contradict the promise of human life, and yet with our faith and our assurance that God is involved in and is redemptively available to us in the midst of that suffering, to preserve a quality of deep-going joy and accessibility to God. And then the emotions of the love of God and the love of neighbor. Now, it's easy to translate the love of God and the love of neighbor into a kind of version of a Kantian categorical imperative, but I think it's important to see it as an emotion, a deep-going disposition of the heart, a formed attitude, loving God and loving neighbor. The only way I know you can develop those sorts of emotions is in community through the practicing of worship, praise, and mission, and service. So, at the heart of the second part of this book, which tries to lead people beyond a notion of self-actualization as the highest principle of human development, is a doctrine of the forming of the religious emotions, the forming of a set of virtues, habits, or strengths of personhood that are required in order for one to be able to live faithfully, and a shaping of passions. I appreciate the testimony at the end to Mormon interest in flesh and bone and bodies. And when I speak about passions, I hope to include that dimension as well. Now, one final word about the call to partnership with God. To me, one of the exciting things about the Mormon tradition and practice, as I understand it, is the fact that you have not fallen into the trap, by and large, that Catholics and Protestants have fallen into, of having created a priestly class and a class of the laos. And you've not confused the calling to partnership with God as something that the ordained have in a special way, and that laypersons have in a secondary or tertiary way. I think that's one of the most robust and exciting things about, at least the way I understand, the Mormon tradition. Therefore, I think there ought to be a kind of congruence between my talking about our partnership with God in substantive ways as partnership with God's creation, God's ongoing activity of creation, partnership with God's governance, God's effort to bring about structures that intend righteousness, that intend uprightness, justice, and goodness in this world, and our cooperation with God's work of liberation and redemption. Those are the primary metaphors I use in talking about what it means to be in partnership with God. And it seems to me that there's a fair amount of resonance between those themes and the way I've tried to develop them and what I understand of the Mormon understanding of what it means to be in partnership with God, bringing about, I call it, a commonwealth of love and justice. Traditionally, we would have called it a kingdom of God. So let's conclude by looking at enlightenment projects and post-enlightenment projects. One of the things that I will try to do in my talk this afternoon, and it's kind of nice that Richard has laid out the helpful perspective on the history of philosophy. One of the things I'll be trying to do this afternoon is to look at the faith stages in relationship to the Enlightenment project, but also asking whether the conjunctive stage of faith points us in the direction of what may be already in place a fairly large-scale transition in cultural consciousness that is the equivalent of what the 18th century Enlightenment represented. And if we can see anything about the vectors and directions of that transition. In that sense, I will be drawing on some of the same figures that Richard draws upon in his hermeneutical interests to suggest that if we are involved in a revolution of consciousness, an evolution of consciousness, in a cultural watershed, somewhat the equivalent of the 18th century Enlightenment, that it will have to be one which doesn't negate the individuation and the use of rational autonomy that the Enlightenment gained at such cost, doesn't negate that, but recontextualizes it in an appreciation for the awareness that we are all involved in process at every level, that any effort to study a phenomenon means to take into account my participation in the phenomenon and the effect of my studying it upon the phenomenon, giving up the kind of distanced objectivity that the Enlightenment so valued, and trying to take account of the interest and the participation of the interrogator in the phenomenon which he or she is trying to question. And I guess most of all, trying to understand our interliving with each other and with nature and with the universe in terms of systems instead of the isolated objective individual. So I'll be trying to lay out those questions this afternoon, and then we'll be looking at the Mormon tradition briefly and probably ignorantly in relation to that possible cultural transition. And I will be arguing, or at least will be suggesting for your appraisal, that in an interesting and rich way, it seems to me the Mormon tradition combines some pre-Enlightenment commitments to particular beliefs, values, myths, and forms of community with a post-Enlightenment commitment to understandings of organization and technology. And in that sense, Mormonism locates itself almost uniquely in the modern world, and then raises the question of what it might mean for the Mormon tradition to embrace or to take account of this cultural transition that I will try to identify. Well, we've played Let You and Them Converse, and in a part or two, Let You and Them Fight. And I've succeeded in saying what I wanted to say with about 15 minutes or so left. I want to give Richard or Marie or Perry an opportunity to briefly respond to or correct anything I've said, but I'm more interested in making all of us open to your questions and your dialogue.
We'll repeat the question. The woman in the green back there.
I had the camera facing me when I took the shot.
of what I think the Mormon myth is. I agree with you. That's the way it's understood. My contention is we probably ought to understand it the other way, that there's more at stake in the difference in the metaphor begetting and creating than just our relationship, how he feels about us. In a begetting relationship, you don't begat unless there's already a relatedness there, fundamental, into which you can be gotten, can be begotten. So I agree, your snapshot of what we commonly talk about within Mormondom, I think, is more accurate. I'm, as I said, this is one particular Mormon's call to think otherwise. But I don't agree with you I guess what I would say is the relatedness issue is critically important, and you if you start with individuals, I don't think you can satisfactorily construct relationships. And that, I think, is one of the things that now is a problem within Mormondom. How can we hold our community together if we're a bunch of individuals? That's all I'm...
Thank you. The gentleman in the back.
Yes, I was very intrigued by your concept of the triad, Dr. Fowler, with the vocational relationship. And I assume that means with me, with community, and then with God. That is the triad. And you also emphasize that it's a covenant relationship. And in Mormonism, we have a lot of covenants and a lot of that concept. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit about what you mean by the covenant that we have with community and with God, and how one goes about entering into that covenant, what the covenant might be. Is it a promise? Is it a formal thing? How do we work the covenant?
I think everyone could hear that. I don't know if the microphone could hear it. It's a question about the meaning and nature of covenant, and the reflection that in the Mormon tradition there is a great deal of emphasis upon covenant. And do I understand it to be a promise? Do I understand it to be a law or a set of commandments or guidelines? And is it a covenant that involves self and neighbor, and self and neighbor as related to God? Thank you for focusing on the question of covenant. It seems to me that if we look for a root metaphor that can hold together both individuality and community, that covenant is the most helpful root metaphor we have available to us. I understand it to be different than social contract, with which it's often confused. Social contract does assume that we are separate individuals, and that community is the product of the willful decision and choice and compacting of a group of autonomous individuals. The other root metaphor we could use would be an organic one, or a body metaphor, the notion that communities are in some sense natural outgrowths of the extension of the family, which is a primordial kind of organic community. Organic communities have the difficulty that it's hard to differentiate an individuum because of the power of the primordial character of the community. Covenant, it seems to me, is both a call to individuals, but it's a kind of call that forms a community, and that in the biblical sense is a call to partnership with God, and I'm using that in a fairly large and inclusive sense. Then the task of the community becomes to discern what it is God is doing and what it means to be in partnership with God. And that's why then we have particular revelations, why we have particular sets of commandments, why the Hebrew community had Torah, which is way or path, and law in the larger sense, and why each particular community within that larger biblical tradition often begins with a fresh sense of covenant and has to try to relate it to earlier recensions of covenant, but has to ask the practical theological and practical ethical question in a given context and a given time: what is God doing here, and what would God have us do and be? And it seems to me that that is the dynamic of a community struggle to define itself and to define its task. Now, if I were speaking specifically within my own Christian tradition, which happens to be a United Methodist Protestant variant of the Christian community, I would say that our determination of what God requires of us or wants of us at any particular time is an ongoing dialogue and action in which we have four elements. A primary one would be Scripture, a continual dialogue with those Scriptures we take to be the record of God's having dealt with Israel and having dealt with the church, and the record in which God discloses what God intends and what God calls us to be and do. A second element, less central but very important, would be the history of the interpretation of those scriptures. We call that tradition. How the church at various points in its past has gone about the question of mediating the relationship between revelation and the present context. A third element would be reason. It seems to me that as responsible and rational characters, creatures, we are called to exercise that capacity for thought, for self-reflection, for sorting out the alternatives and imperatives that impinge upon us. Reason. And the fourth would be experience. And I include among our ways of consulting experience such disciplines as the social sciences. How do human beings work? Our understanding of political systems and economic systems. So I'm not giving a very determinate answer, but I'm talking about a method of discerning what covenant means in a given time. But the crucial thing that is at stake for me is this triadic pattern of self and neighbor, self and community, and God, and of fact that the community is called into being by God's action. Therefore, relationship is prior, but it's the relationship God establishes with us and establishes between us. And in that sense, covenant community is not necessarily made up of people who would have chosen to be together. And part of what's astonishing about any good church is how we are called to learn to stand each other in that community. Because God has called us into community rather than our kind of affinity electing each other.
Can I just say a little bit more? Having read some of the things you've talked about in that light, I looked very differently to at the words of Alma at the Waters of Mormon when he talks about the baptismal covenant and what you're really promising to do. And it really is, he talks about a covenant with community, you know, to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those who stand in need and comfort. And so I think that element is very much there in Mormonism, but I think it's gone to the background a little bit, and part of it is a consolidated meeting schedule. We could get you can't create community with a consolidated meeting schedule.
Yes.
Dr. Fowler could define for me a new term, which is God and partnership with God.
What did you want me to do with it?
Define what is God and what is a partnership.
In 4 minutes, please.
Take the metaphors that I used a moment ago, and I do believe that all of our language about God is metaphorical. And that may be a fundamental differing point. I said that in the presence of a man in Alaska who, from that point on, regarded me as a heretic. And I said all of our language about God is metaphorical. Metaphorical language, I understand, meta, meaning crossing over or beyond where we normally would go, and therein, the Greek, means to carry over, to bear us over. Language about God, like the language of poetry, often carries us into dimensions of experience where we could not go using ordinary language. So please join with me in acknowledging the metaphorical character of our language. God is more than and in some sense not fully accessible to our linguistic ways of talking about God. I see God as creator, as source and center of all that has value and being. All that is derives from God. Nature is not identical with God, but God permeates nature. In that sense, I may be a panentheist. God is prior to, but God expresses God's self in creation. God is also governor. God is present as logos, as reason, as purpose in creation. None of these metaphors exhaust God's being, but they give us windows into God's being. God is present in reality as a structuring that intends justice or righteousness. Paul Tillich said this well. He says, it's not so much that we break the laws of God, but we break ourselves upon them. There is a logos, a rationality in the processes of nature and history. And third, I use the metaphors of God as liberator and redeemer. And I take those to be biblical metaphors, God's liberation of slaves in Egypt and forming of them a people who are to be a nation of priests, God's calling of us out of the bondage of sin and death and hell and self-absorption to partnership. We'll come to partnership in a moment. Liberation, redemption, meaning God's efforts preeminently in Christ, but in many other ways as well, to bring about a restoration of human beings who are given finite freedom and the anxiety and the creativity that come with finite freedom, God's effort to restore relationship with God and appropriate relationships with neighbor and with nature. God is liberator and redeemer. Partnership means, for me, our taking our junior partnership place in relation to these activities of God so that we become co-creators in a finite sense. So that in our art and architecture and medical sciences and agriculture and education, we are participating in God's ongoing work of creation. We become partners in God's governance, in the forming and maintaining of good law, in the effort to create just institutions, in the effort to reach equitable systems of distribution of goods and services and life chances. We participate in God's governance. And through our partnership with God's liberating and redemptive work, we are part of God's evangelium, part of the proclamation of God's good news and call to repentance and call to new life. That's the way I would answer your question.
I think that provides a good stopping point for us. We're within 2 minutes of the conclusion of this session. We invite you to hear Dr. Fowler this afternoon, and I think there will be an opportunity following that session to spend some more time with him if you have additional questions. Thank you very much.